Blog Talk Radio.
Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
end of the month. I hope everybody who's got Social Security or whatever is getting paid, because they run out of cash and time's running out fast. Good evening, and welcome as we get into another adventure with all the chefs here at Soul Tree Radio in the Raw. I'm your host, Michael Lewis Engelman. As always, it is good to be with you. Soul Tree Radio in the Raw, proudly sponsored by BASNNewsroom.com and the assassin of the Black Athlete Sports Network. Get all the good shit, the who, what, when, where, why, and how, right now at www.BASNNewsroom.com. Shout out to the members of the Brother Man Network, who we will be commiserating with in a few minutes here. Sorry. Stumbling a little bit because I just came out the movies. Now, movies are intriguing. You know, when I lived in Canada, I found out it may have already been something that everybody else knew. I didn't know. But Tuesday was cheap movie day. You could see all the first run features for $6 Canadian, which is like $4 US. It was kind of nice. And it was kind of a cool habit to get into. However, it was the kind of movie you'd watch that always made the difference. You had me flashback to when I was a teenager and I had to hit the deuce. 40 Deuce, 42nd Street, where they had the cheap movies. Two movies for $3.50. And of course, if you went to the upper balcony, it was the smoking section, if you know how I say it. My brother Tony McClay came in, has come into the frame. But the double feature I just saw was interesting. Tony, the titles were The Killing Joke and The Return of the Boston Strangler. Have you seen either one of these?
The Return, now, are we talking The Batman Killing Joke or?
You're on the right track.
Okay. And what was the other one?
The Return of the Boston Strangler.
I saw the original, didn't see the the Tony. I'm dating myself. The Tony Curtis one that came out in the theaters. That's the one I remember.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's the right one. Now, 40 years ago, there was another Boston Strangler who came into Heart Belt of Beantown and rocked their world. He cut apart and cut down everybody who had a Celtics jersey. His name was Andrew Tony, and he was, as they say in the parlance, a bad motherfucker. He so worried the Boston Celtics that the next year they went out and got Dennis Johnson in a desperate attempt to try to match up to the advantage the Sixers had gained. Fortunately for the Sixers, they got their title before they owed their fans 3 or 4, whatever it was they said they were owing them. But The Killing Joke refers to Nikola Jokic, who brought the Denver Nuggets to the finals for the first time ever with all the great players they've had, Alex English, Dan Issel, Fat Lever, Kiki Vandeweghe. This is the first time the Denver Nuggets, throwing Spencer Haywood too. It's the first time the Nuggets have been included. And for once, the league is right. Jokic is a legitimately good player. He is the best European player I've seen since Drazen Petrovic. And they're both Serbs, I believe. But the whole point is, it's like, you know, if you're good enough, come on in, get down, and let everybody see whether you got game or not. I believe he's got game.
And I have to admit, I've been a bit critical, you know, because he was the two-time MVP. But you're right. He definitely can play. There is no, you know, excuse me. The thing with Denver, and again, you know, they're finally all the old ABA teams have now made it to the NBA finals. Now,
right?
They were literally like that old Warner Brothers cartoon. They were like the last of the Mohegans. They were definitely Mohegan in regards to this. But they're not the flashiest bunch, and you sort of get caught up in all the scoring. You know, they're sort of like a lot of the Western Conference teams where they're going to score a lot of points. The defense, it's a little bit better than we probably give it credit for, but still, they're not going to shut down anybody per se. But again, for what they've had to do, it works out well. And he definitely has a Robin with him with Murray. And Murray has been sort of a poor man's type scorer. You know, people forget, I think, when, before he hurt his knee seriously a few years ago, he was one of the best scorers in the league. And I think he's gotten back to that level and spades. It's, you know, after that, it's a lot of like role players and, you know, solid players. They don't really have, you know, the crazy thing is really have a quote unquote grizzled veteran. Now, a lot of it may have to do with just how the NBA is now, because you don't see, you know, that very rarely you see those, you know, guys, you know, like, I mean, basically like Al Horford would be considered sort of like a grizzled veteran, so to speak. And but that doesn't count because Al's older than his daddy, but that's a whole other story in and of itself.
Right.
But yeah, they don't really wow you per se, but I wouldn't say they're like lunch pail, so to speak, but they're just, the thing with them is that they just basically go there, come to work. Now, the whole thing with Jokic is that the one thing I do take a little bit, they try to say that he's the best passing, one of the best passing big men ever. For this era, definitely. But I think, I think this is where folks have that convenient memory loss. People forget that, you know, Will Chamberlain was a, you know, for all the points that he scored, what have you.
I'm glad
Wilt
you said
was also
Wilt.
A guy. Wilt was also was a guy that would. Matter of fact, the rumor was that, you know, the year after he led the league in scoring with averaging 50 points a game. Yep, that's what I said. 50 points a game he averaged.
There you go.
He went out the next year and basically said he was going to stop, not going to stop shooting, but he was going to dish more. And if I remember correctly, he wound up leading the league in assists. I think he's still the only center to ever lead the NBA in assists, if I remember correctly.
I think is right, sir.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Jokic, you know, Jokic, fundamentally sound, can look a little crazy out there sometimes because he'll hoist some crazy shots up and they'll go in. And
right.
I know Anthony Davis has had a couple of double takes it's actually going to be, we're probably going to get basically, I don't want to say two new teams because Denver's really the new team. Miami's been to this Miami team has been to the finals behind Mr. Butler. And they probably won't get the sweep, but still, let's just say it, you know, King Kong, Great Bait, Magilla Gorilla, Gorgo,
great bait.
Ain't got nothing on, yeah, yeah, they ain't got nothing on Jimmy during the postseason.
Right about that.
And at, you know, he has to be mentioned in the same breath as a lot of the all-time greats when it comes to the postseason.
That's where the new Boston Strangler comes in. Jimmy Butler out of Marquette University has got to be the new Boston Strangler. He has lit up the Boston Celtics. Miami is 3-0, a surprising 3-0 they were before they lost last night. And barring a huge, huge collapse, it should be Denver-Miami in the finals. And Jimmy Butler is one of those guys that he has the game and the attitude to go with it. He reminds me of my granddaughters, Kaylee, Masika, and Elena. It's like, fuck that sugar and spice shit. All three of them are there like, I'm a little bit of sage, a little bit of hood. And all of them look at you like, I wish a motherfucker would.
You know.
And Butler has that mentality.
He's Patrick Beverly with talent.
Yes.
Because Patrick Beverly can be whatever, but Patrick Beverly is, you know, he spends more time being the knucklehead as opposed to whatever. You know, he's never gonna like beat you one on one or whatever, but he's just annoying. But Butler will do that and beat you as well. To me, the turning point of the series was when Williams basically tried to get into a "my dick is bigger than your dick" thing in game two, and I think it cost them, especially that game.
Yeah, I think you're right. As I was putting the show together tonight, I asked my intern Lanlin to put a package together for Jim Brown, and we both know, and thanks to you, we did get the opportunity to interview him once, or at least
yes,
once. And I thank them for discovering the Friends of Distinction. I can dig it, she can dig it, we can dig it, he can dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it. Oh, let's see.
I never knew that.
I was wondering whether I was going to get it right all the way through. But anyway, I asked Lanlin to put something together about Jim Brown, and as a good intern should, she answered the question, how good was Jim Brown?
Just watch how this free little device fixes my internet, and it's so much faster. Okay, look.
Jim Brown is widely considered the most dominant football player to ever live. Blazing speed combined with brutalizing power, his game is like a mythical being. When the Cleveland Browns were at their heights, yes, 60 years ago, Jim Brown was at the epicenter of the NFL's explosion in popularity. But it's been over a half a century since Brown graced the NFL. So, just how good was he actually? Jim Brown was born on February 10, 1936, on St. Simon's Island off the coast of Georgia. His father, a pro boxer, left when he was an infant. Not long after, his mother moved to Manhasset, New York, to try and start a new life for her and her son. Young Jim was raised by just his grandmother and great-grandmother in a dirt-poor Georgia home until he was 8. By then, his mother built up enough of a life to move Jim up to New York with her. It wasn't long before we found out just how one-of-a-kind Jim Brown was. Incredible players are labeled Mr. Do-It-All all the time, but no one could do everything like Brown could. His 13 high school varsity letters, prove it. Football, obviously, check. He averaged 15 yards a carry in high school. Basketball, he averaged 38 points per game for Manhasset, a record that stood until Carl Yaz, a future Triple Crown winner, broke it. Baseball, he threw 2 no-hitters as a senior and had the New York Yankees looking at him. Track, he was a high jump champion in Nassau County. Lacrosse, we'll get to it later. Just take our word and check it off. Jim Brown went down in high school lore and took that same mentality to Syracuse University in 1953. Brown lettered in 4 sports at Syracuse: basketball, track, football, and lacrosse. The crazy part is, he didn't even receive a scholarship at all, and unwritten rules tried to derail Brown at every step. Syracuse football didn't allow freshmen to play at the time, burying Brown 5th on the depth chart. As a basketball player, he was the Orange's best athlete, a ferocious defender and rebounder. Brown averaged 13 points, but Syracuse had an idiotic, unwritten rule that didn't allow 3 black players to start. Despite being one of their best players, Jim's success came from the bench. As a senior, Brown couldn't take it anymore and quit the hardwood. While he was making his way up the running back depth chart, Brown was making a name in every other sport. He was known for showing up to track meets, then immediately leaving and dominating on the lacrosse field in the same day. I don't think you're hearing us. Brown competed in a high jump competition before hanging a hat trick on Army's lacrosse team. In fact, Jim Brown was so good at lacrosse, not only did he consider it his best sport, they had to change the rules because of his dominance. He led Syracuse to an undefeated championship in lacrosse, won the Lacrosse Heisman Award, and became the sport's first Black Hall of Famer. He's widely considered the best lacrosse midfielder of all time. But let's get to football. As a sophomore, Brown was still the team's fifth-string running back. By the end of his senior season, he was a unanimous All-American selection. Against Colgate, Brown found the end zone six times and kicked seven PATs. He could do it all, remember? Setting a single-game scoring record at 43 points. After finishing fifth
points
in the Heisman as a senior, Brown made his way to the NFL. With
all the way back in 1957,
the Cleveland Browns made their best decision in franchise history and selected Jim Brown. From the minute he stepped foot in the league, he flipped the football world on its head. At 6'2", 220 pounds, Jim Brown was stronger, faster, and more athletic than anybody the NFL had seen yet. He was untouchable in the open field, elusive between the tackles, impossible to bring down in the alley, and enjoyed contact more than anyone else. He never finished a run by going out of bounds, electing to punish anybody that tried him. Make sure when anyone tackles you, he remembers how much it hurts. That's a direct quote from Jim Brown on his running style. In his rookie season, he made sure every team felt the pain. The Browns started the year 6-1-1, but Jim Brown's numbers were modest by his standards, tallying just 100-yard game. That is, until he put on paper the greatest game of football to ever be played at that point. In Week 9 against the Rams, Brown carried the ball 31 times for 237 yards and 4 touchdowns. That 237 yards was an all-time record, the first 200-yard game in NFL history. It stood as the rookie rushing record for nearly 60 years. The four scores became a staple of Brown's statue, as he would go on to record more triple and quadruple touchdown days than anyone else in history. That day in Cleveland showed a glimpse of what Brown would bring in his second season. Even though Brown was an NFL MVP as a rookie, his sophomore year blew every number he posted out of the water. In a 12-game season, Jim ran for 1,526 yards, shattering the old record by nearly 500 yards. In a full 17-game current NFL season, Brown would have been on pace to become one of football's few 2,000-yard rushers. The second-leading touchdown scorer in 1958 had 8 touchdowns. Jim Brown, the league leader, had 17, over double that. He doubled the entire league in production. In just 2 seasons, Brown staked his claim as the greatest player in the NFL, a 2-time rushing title leader, and 2-time NFL MVP. His relentless attack of the pylon was only matched by his balance and speed. He ran away from crowds with ease and was the hardest man to tackle since the creation of the pigskin. The only skill more incredible than his ability on the field was that he was always available. Despite leading the league in carries and rushing yards over the next 3 seasons, he never missed a game. Talk about a fantasy draft dream. Brown was a walking 100-yard, 1-touchdown game that never missed. No, really. From his third season in 1959 all the way through 1961, he averaged over 100 yards per game and never had a season with less than 8 touchdowns. He was also first-team All-Pro and Pro Bowler each of his first 5 seasons. 1962, Brown's 6th season, would be the only season that he would not lead the NFL in rushing. His 962 yards was 4th in the league, and it would be considered a huge disappointment. Yeah, finishing a top 5 rusher was considered Brown's worst season. Dig a little deeper, and you'll find that he played with a broken toe the entire season and still scored 18 touchdowns. Damn. He was that guy. 62 was just a setup for one of the greatest seasons of all time. In 1963, Jim Brown came back with a vengeance, and it started right from week one, where he had 2 of the best plays of his career, one where he received one of his patented pitch plays and took it 80 yards untouched for a touchdown, then a screen where he broke 7 tackles and miraculously spun out of 3 Washington defenders for an 83-yard touchdown.
Here are the top 3 dirty self-defense moves. Number 1, throwing dirt in your opponent's eyes.
That was
throwing an object into your opponent's eyes that
finished that game with 262 total yards and three touchdowns. He preceded the 63 season by shredding every defense in his path. His 1,500-yard single-season record, he shattered it, rushing for 1,863 yards in 14 games. Just how good is that? At 133 yards per game, he would have totaled 2,261 yards in a full NFL season today, over 150 more yards than the single-season record. Jim Brown really didn't like anyone else holding his rushing crown. 1964 might be the most special season of his career. Brown became the first player to score 100 touchdowns, and he did it in just 93 games, a record that would stand for 50 years. And more importantly, he reached the pinnacle of team sports. The Cleveland Browns won the 1964 NFL Championship. When Brown entered the league, his single-season rushing record was 1,146 yards. Brown broke that in 7 of his 9 seasons. In 1965, Brown had another dominant season. He scored 17 rushing touchdowns and 21 total touchdowns, the most of his career. His 1,544 rushing yards were the second most ever, behind only himself 2 years prior. Brown also took home his third NFL MVP award. At the top of the world, 30 years old and still with at least 4 or 5 elite seasons left, Brown shocked the world by retiring. Jim Brown retired as the first player to ever break 10,000 rushing yards. His 8 rushing titles in 9 seasons will never be touched. Neither will his 5 rushing touchdown leader seasons. To this day, his 108 rushing touchdowns is still 6th. Mind you, there's been 52 Super Bowls since he stopped playing. There are 2 categories that aren't influenced by year that can compare any runner regardless of era: yards per game and yards per carry. Jim Nathaniel Brown is the king of both. His 104.3 rushing yards per game, the only person to average 100 yards per game, will never be touched. It's nearly 5 yards more than second, which just so happens to be the same amount of yards he got every time he touched the rock, averaging 5.2 yards per carry. The 12,312 yards he ran for in just 9 seasons stood for nearly 20 seasons, and it took Walter Payton 25 more games to do it. How good was Jim Brown actually? Well, he's the greatest pure runner and the most dominant player the NFL has ever seen. He's the NFL's version of Wilt Chamberlain, with stats that don't even make sense. Most importantly, he was the ultimate pioneer for the NFL and the game of football, with his play helping grow the game to the product we have today.
This is where John Facenda would have said, Jim Brown, he was one bad motherfucker. Because...
How much more? You know, and thank you for using that. Remember, I sent that to you. You don't even need. I mean, that's beyond a mic drop. That's beyond the mic drop, and I think still you still have to, you know, and see if you get, you know, I'm. You know, YouTube should be paying me for as much as I bring it up. But
yeah,
if you really, really want to get a sense of it, go to, you know, literally go to YouTube, put in Jim Brown, and just sit for about half hour, 2 hours, or what have you, and just watch a collage of his runs. Because some, and now there, look, because of the era that we're in regards to sports analysis, and I say that literally with tongue in cheek, you know, they will try to belittle what he's done. But the thing with him, to me, the speed, the power, and the over, and see, it was a, you know, there's a particular NFL Films thing where you have a lot of his contemporaries talk about him. And
yeah,
there's a thing where you see him doing his push-ups without his helmet on. He just has his football stuff on, and he's just in. And, it, you know, folks were in awe of him. And the thing is,
exactly,
everything, you know, I believe he was a psych major. As well, I'm not sure. You know, Patrick might be able to elaborate on that
smart.
A little bit more than I can.
The thing that
was always the most impressive with him was that he would go out of his way to get up as slow as humanly possible. And he wanted everybody to think, oh, we got him.
We got him now.
We got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then 80 yards later, it's like, And much like Jackie Robinson, his best sport wasn't football. You know, there. You know, his lacrosse. I mean, he was. You know, he's probably the best lacrosse player that's ever played in the United States ever. I mean, put it this way. Do you know of any other lacrosse players that can be mentioned in the same breath as Jim Brown?
No fucking way. It reminds me of when
maybe Jim Thorpe.
Jim
Thorpe.
Yeah,
but really. Tony's point, but I mean, if you look at a modern day athlete, right, with all the training and weightlifting and all the different things that go into that, you know, Jim, right, you know, would be a person, Jim Brown, rest in power, would be a person, whereas you could just look at his silhouette and know it was Jim Brown, right?
Yes.
All you needed was a cutout and it's complete shadows.
Yes.
And you know it was Jim Brown. And the thing about what you said, I mean, what, the first four seasons of his career were 12-game seasons.
Yes.
They play 17 now.
Yes.
You know, they implemented in his fifth year is when they went to the 14-game season. So it literally half his career was on a 12-game trajectory. And so that analysis breakdown was something I thought about in the past, was basically football's version of Wilt. And so when you measure Chamberlain, you have to measure players of that magnitude basically on what that breakdown was, right, that we just heard. Because it was really covering that. But when you think about the fact he played 48 games his first four seasons, you know, he didn't play that many games and averaged 100 yards a game, this and that. But, you know, 13 years of his life was just as a football player.
That's true.
You count college. You count 9 years as a pro. His legacy was just built on 9 years, and then all he did afterwards in a lot of different other capacities as well. And
a brother like Jim Brown, and everyone caught up.
A brother like Jim Brown would be better remembered from his perspective too. He rarely glossed over his career. Right,
no
as much as he's talking about being a positive.
Yeah.
He rarely glossed over his career, and when a person dies, right, they can talk about, you know, like, oh, Jim, the greatest. He was so much as a brother, as a black man, as an example to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a young person, seeing him just on observation and his works and the way he spoke and conducted himself, this, that, and the other, and from a public perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Complete role model as a brother. It was nothing crackazoid or sell-outish or apologetic about Jim Brown. Zilch.
Absolutely.
Zilch.
You know, the iconic, the summit. You mentioned that to people of a certain age, they know exactly what you're talking about. You know,
right.
When Roland began blackathlete.com years ago.
Rest
one of
power.
I'm hoping him and Roland are getting
double
together
R.
as we speak.
Yep.
Yes. That picture was, I think, on our site for like the longest time, and I made it a point to when we implemented our Facebook page a few years ago. That was our cover picture. I replaced it a few times just for certain events, but literally and figuratively. When I heard about JB passing, I had to put it back on there because to me that is one of the most, if not the most iconic sports picture of all time. When you see all, I mean, you know, forgive me, but to me that's like the last supper, as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Absolutely.
And only a person like
Absolutely.
That, unyielding, uncompromising, 100% a brother. As there's no shuffle in Jim Brown. That's how I always seen him.
There you go.
You know, yes, I never seen no shuffle, yes, hunched over, just dribble, just football, fell out, MF forever, you know, in Jim Brown and how he conducted his business. His conduction was masculine force of, like, a warrior-type zone, right? You know, that, mm-hmm, but also on the,
yeah,
mental tip. You know what I'm saying? Not just, you know, on the Sonny Liston brute shit, right? A cat that could think on its feet, you know, and who projected an image of vigor, you know, projected an image of positivity. You know, O.J. tried to mimic it, but we all know how he failed there. But the thing was, that Jim, you're right, he tried to mimic it, he failed there. But see, Jim, you know, he rode with Ben Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, you know, prior to all the stuff, and then he was one of Ali's, you know, ace booms, right? You know, he ran with them. You know, they talked about the really good thing Regina King did on, I believe, Prime.
Yeah. Yes.
Went after Ali B. Clifton, right?
A night in Miami.
Matter of fact, I was in Miami one time, and they had the actual play before it hit the movies. It's just, I was so unfortunate that they canceled it that particular night. I was planning on going, but he was actually riding shotgun with Ali during that time frame, and then, you know, the cat that broke his heart was he negotiated one of the best deals for Richard Pryor, but Richard was on the white stuff, and he kind of trained him at the end, you know what I'm saying? It really hurt him, broken.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Jim Brown who positioned that. And then let's fast forward to the one time I met when he had the UCAN thing right for the gang summit where he was bringing the Bloods and Crips. He had a program where he was going to high schools in California, you know, bringing this UCAN program where he would talk. It was a mess, you know, in that era back then, you know, with gang activity. It was out of control, and he put that together. And he was the first person, not LAPD, that got a truce between the Blood and Crips because both leaders met at his house. He brought these people to his house. So, in other words, all the way down to a prominent figure like Muhammad Ali, to the grassroots community in the hood, you know, when people were doing certain things in the streets of L.A., you know, he was front and center, grassroots. Not like today where people get these fabulous salaries that were established, like people like Jim Brown, like Wilt, get these fabulous salaries, so they just throw money at the cost. But they're not boots on the ground. And they get that tax write-off, too.
And I think that's the reason why he was so hated by white establishment because they couldn't take credit for anything he did.
He didn't sell out.
And
got on free with Raquel Welch, their hero. You know, their heroine, right? You know, broke those barriers, right? 100 rifles, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, it looked like Jim had 200 rifles possibly, right? Not 100 rifles.
Well, it was definitely at least on one rifle.
The Dirty Dozen, right? He cut on Art Modell so he could go film that movie, you know, overseas.
True
the
that.
Dirty Dozen was a hot flick. But see, Whitey can't stand anyone that's going to look him in the eye and like a block of granite and be unyielding. And when he went down to Texas, redneck Texas, when Syracuse went down there to play Texas, and it was like Texas back then, Dallas was considered murder capital of the United States, redneck. I mean, they actually put out a wanted ad on JFK while he was sitting in office, you know, and so it was really hated. And he went down to the heart of Dixie and turned it out.
And Eric, that game against the Rams where he set the record,
right?
He ran for almost 8 yards to carry that day. 8 yards.
Mm.
And this is long before sophisticated equipment. It may have been before NFL film said, wait a minute, look at this motherfucker. This cat is bad. And he just went Doberman on the ass.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at all of his pictures, right, or any image from his playing career, and nothing touches the photographic artwork of those photographers from that era, right? The photos just don't—they just come off different, right? Because there was no internet, there was no YouTube, right? No Instagram, where now you know more photos have been taken in the world. The last, and with the invention of the cell phone, there's been more photos taken in the history of the planet the last 10 years because of the cell phone. You get so many photos, so the great majority of photos are taken. Yet, what attracted many people to liking sports, if you didn't watch many televised games, was the photography, correct? Because you got your information from newspapers, and you got your information from magazines. Right, and so Sports Illustrated, they had outstanding photographers. None beats the photographers of Ebony and Jet, though, right? Because they had incredible photographers. That's what makes those magazines pop. Yes, that's what makes the Getty Museum. I mean, bought all of that archives of footage from those magazines. They own all of Johnson & Johnson photos. Sad but true, brothers weren't bidding on that. Byron Allen wasn't bidding on that shit, you know what I'm saying? Because that photography auto lens archive, you ever want to do any kind of research in the subject matter in the black community, Jet got it. You know, 1945, 46, and all the photography. Yeah, I mean, it's dope. And so, Brown, when you look at those old photography, be it black and white images or color images, everything is 1,000% serious. The ultimate game.
Yes, it is.
It's about pieces not hanging out of the side of his face. He doesn't have 12 headbands on or 39 tattoos. Just the brother. He's standing in his own strength. Brown just represented me as a cat that just stood in his own strength 24/7, and it projected, and he performed. I mean, it was such, that's why they hated the brother. It's in his example.
Absolutely. I mean, nobody wore 32 like Jim Brown.
Nobody wore 32. Who wore 32 on the Browns before Jim Brown put it on? That definitely would buy your beer at a bar. I'm still trying to find out.
That's a great question.
Yeah,
one thing you got to remember is one time they didn't have numbers, and then at another time they had numbers. But they didn't have the system where backs wore one number, ends wore 80s.
Yeah. Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. They had that brother that wore number 78. Marion Motley? Was that him?
Motley.
Wore 76. 76.
Mm-hmm.
76. 76. I think Motley wore 76.
Yeah.
He wore 76. I mean, it was bugged out, right? Because quarterbacks, you can have all kinds of number ranges. And then the NFL started coming with a number system, you know, and then they had to change
that. That was mid to late 50s.
Recently. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Like linebackers.
They
90s. You couldn't wear 90s as a linebacker in the 70s. That was basically defensive linemen could wear 90s.
Indeed.
Right. And then receivers could not wear single digits for a while, even though I can still see number 7 Eddie Bell for the Jets, you know, with that single digit.
It's funny because see Lawrence Taylor wore 98 at UNC and he wanted to wear 98. He wanted to wear it in the pros.
He had
56. Yeah.
Well, they let him. They let him wear it. I guess in one or two. I think like his first preseason game, they allowed him to wear it, but then he had to change it to 56. Once the season
that
started.
That happened to Bosworth too, right? Because he was 44 at Oklahoma.
Yeah, he went to 44,
and he had to go
right.
to 50. And it 55. Happened to Coach Prime. Because he was 2 at Florida State, and he had to go 21 in the pro. Because they didn't allow single digits to DB at that time. Now they do, but at that time.
Oh, that's right.
And
then stopped Reggie Bush 105, too. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah,
exactly.
Now it seems like it's a big deal.
Now you can sport 5, correct. Yeah. And then, you know, you had those guys that were like, what's his name? He had the right number, but there used to be. this is going back, but I'm amongst sports historians here. This guy Red Grange wore 77 in the back.
77, Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen some. Yeah, you know, it's funny. You know, now that you have marketing, now it's, you know, now that was definitely fly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm not gonna go to a quick tangent, but please, home whites and dark grays or dark colors for road unis, okay? I'm so tired of them.
It's a kaleidoscope of colors, man. For like you said, this is like jersey sales. But you know, back to Jim Brown though, right? So there's many people who, when they first heard of Jim Brown, thought the football team was named after him.
Exactly. Yeah.
How dope is that? You're going to be that football player, right? And you're literally playing for a team of your last name.
Yep.
You know, and these are the things that you just can't make up. You know, we're not playing for the Chamberlains or the LeBrons or the Jordans. Jim Brown played for the Browns.
Mm-hmm.
He played for the Browns. And
his whole career.
That thing you referred to, other players talking about Brown, there was a linebacker who played for the Colts. His name was Steve Stonebreaker, and he was a redneck. I mean, he was a redneck.
Yes.
And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was one of those. He would have stuck to Jim Brown 99 times out of 100. But when he finally saw Jim Brown, that was time number 100. And it wasn't happening. He said, I respect him as a man. Respect him as a man. You knew he was going to get that ass whipped if he wasn't going to respect him. This is the problem that sports stars, when I talk about playing or being super nigga, they can't handle it. You know, unfortunately, we saw the end of LeBron James as the cash cow. You know, and in the series against Denver. And again, credit to Jokic. But the bottom line in the deal is, ain't but so many supermen around. Jim Brown was one. LeBron James was one. Really, he wore the mask, and everybody lost their damn mind. You can't look like that. Go wear something clear. We can't have you looking that black and that menacing. Jim Brown didn't even need a mask. By himself, he was menacing. And it was all that, I feel threatened. Well, Kel Welch didn't feel threatening 100 rifles, nor did Stella Stevens in Slaughter. He played the role. He sold his soul, and he went all the way in making sure that the story of the black athlete got told. And it didn't cost him anything but his manhood. Small price to pay. He's here to stay.
Well, you look at Jim, you mentioned LeBron, you know, he grew up in Ohio. And, you know, he mentioned that, you know, Jim Brown was like a god to him growing up. So how much of a factor in his example, because LeBron played football as well, and Jim Brown was down low. Mm-hmm. The power of symbolisms and the power of role models is the reason why they built statues. It's the reason why they put, you know, slave owners on dollar bill on money that, you know, Jiggers love so much and shit. And they're looking at Ben Franklin giving them the middle finger at the same damn time. You know what I mean? It's the reality of it all, right? So who's your example? You know what I mean? And so people will pursue these tokens of things external to themselves to try to optimize their personal persona. But a person like Jim Brown to a young man like LeBron James, hearing the stories growing up in Ohio, seeing him and seeing his level of fitness, how did that motivate LeBron to be such a fit athlete? See, these are the ethers. The power of transmutation of having right role models and the right male imagery in the minds of young black men that they can pursue, regardless if that's going to be your chosen sport or not. Ali was that guy. Ali's more powerful as an example and a role model Ali can lose four fights and, you know, still be considered like the greatest, right? You know, which is subject to debate when you take a couple of L's, right? But the reality is that the persona, because of the representation of what you see, the regalness, you see these brothers like King, you see these brothers like, you know, the prominent ones that we all talk about, Malcolm. Look at how they stand. Look at how they comport themselves. Look at how they speak. That has more power. People will walk around with these posters and these hats, right, and buttons and imagery. They're projecting the power of the example. And that was Jim Brown. See, that's something that where LeBron James starts his trajectory in his career. He has that. I mean, Kareem's template was Wilt. You know, he can talk about Wilt and they can have their little disagreements, but Wilt was his template. Wilt brought him in if he likes it or not or accepts it or not. And then a guy like LeBron, okay, he's going to like it. That's the same thing that happened at Barry Bonds when he's looking at Willie Mays. He is not the same Barry Bonds of Willie Mays. It's not in his trajectory.
True that.
These are the examples that they try to destroy. That's why they don't want no brothers in the household or no men around projecting those positive images and standing up strong. That's well past the effing money crap people love to lock in on. What's your example? What are you standing on? What can I look at you? How do you move? How do you walk? Because what people are looking at. They give a damn about that. I mean, Sammy Davis Jr., ain't no one following his style. He was wearing all kinds of bling. It's what you do and what you stand for. That's what Brown represented. And I say this because these are the type of people, like the coach McLendon's and rest in peace, like a guy like Ralph Boston, who just recently died, right, who won a gold medal in 1960 Olympics, right? He's the first one to clear 27 feet, right? And he was someone who beelined me when I was at Tennessee State because he heard I was a campus and who my father was. And I just cannot remember at the force. And expediently, he was walking towards me. I didn't know who he was. And my goodness, I felt like I was talking to an uncle once he started talking to me in terms of the vibe, the energy. And I was just so impressed with the example. He gave me his business card at the time. He was doing insurance in Knoxville. And he was on that Olympic team, and he was real cool with Ali. He was real cool with Wilma Rudolph. Ali was dating Wilma Rudolph at the time, you know, broke her up some money, ran into some hard times. You know what I'm saying? But this was these brothers all together. So you get this filter of that energy and these examples, and Wilma conducted herself, Skeeter, as my mother called it, a great way. You know, Kennedy had to sit down with her. She got gold, right? And she's a legend in what she does well before her time. Ali's unspoken. But then we got Ralph who did these things. And then you take these things for young people who have maybe seen this, like LeBron witnessing Jim Brown, watching Jim Brown, hearing about Jim Brown, meeting Jim Brown. But he's like, okay, I can go this route. And so none of these NBA players like Kareem reached out to LeBron. LeBron has no father. He has no male figure in his household. How
That's
much
right.
power did the example of Jim Brown play into him and his manhood? And he speaks to that in his Twitter tweet with Jim Dodd. You see what I'm saying? This is
point.
The connectivity and that we want to talk about here and get away from that jock shit. It's that example, man.
And it begs
I'm
the
out.
Question. Yeah, it begs the question, what would have happened if LeBron had gone to Ohio State, even for 1 year? What would his career have been like? They were prepping him
Maurice
for everything
Claret
that they
shit,
could do.
Right? Yeah, Maurice Claret, not, right? I mean, not like he would follow the line. LeBron has no baby mamas. He has no criminal record. He has no speeding tickets. He ain't been in court. You know, he hasn't done other things.
He's like Cowboy Reggie.
Right.
He got Reggie with his job.
Okay, cool. So you look at those examples, and he's following the example he's seen in Jim Brown and speaks so strongly with that. And he literally said, Jim, now they call him King James. So he says, Jim Brown's God. So to LeBron, in his eye, growing up as a young man, and someone that's accomplished this, he's saying that he's not the creator of the universe and the world, all that kind of thing, like for the religious types. But he is correct in his concept of saying that he created a godlike image in this young man's mind. But a godlike image that's touchable, that you can connect to, that has flaws, that you can be an example to and that you can get with. And that if that helps him in his career and now puts him in a position, how much did Jim Brown doing movies position LeBron to do all the productions he does?
Good point.
Hmm? I already know there's a connection between two. I'm just wording it that way. And LeBron talks phenomenal things with movie production. The documentary, the one on Ali, there's a bunch of others he's got there going. And it pops up so little, Braun production. So, but he took it 10 light years past Jim, but he built off Jim as an example. Mm-hmm.
Tony, before you go, give everybody a little rundown of the hardship cases. You know, we got Kobe, we got Moses Malone, and we have players who they came in without any papers. They came in on hardship. They decided they didn't want to go to college. Whatever the deal was, they needed an alternative route, and they got one. You know, LeBron turned out to be the best of the best only because he had a support system. I mean, can we imagine Kobe or Moses playing ball at Reggie? I brought up Moses playing for HBCU. Can we see all that? Anybody?
I mean, you can. I mean, basically, if you look at it from what you're sharing, I mean, Bill Willoughby was like the first one to get drafted, right, out of Englewood, New Jersey, to the pros, out of high school. Moses, you know, he went to the ABA first, and he got his get down on. Yet, you know, Kobe was just incredible. It was totally different. He's the son of an NBA player, and he grew up primarily in Italy, yet, you know, he had the work ethic of, you know, 20 people. Like, he had something to prove on the day. A lot of that, though, with hyper, super respect, because I, you know, the Bean, I mean, you know, been in his presence, and that's another story. I felt like, you know, it was a son or a family member that, you know, took that fatal, you know, thing. So it still has that kind of component. But see, Kobe also had this situation where he had, you know, a tick, you know, and his tick was, you know, this incredible narcissistic deal and motivation that he would try to channel that energy where he had maybe a deficit, you know, in a certain carry mentally, but he would project that and recycle that into just going at basketball and just projecting his energy this way to kind of counter it, right? That's a different story in itself, but he was highly successful. So out of college, you know, Garnett, another person, you know, that didn't go to college that had, you know, really good career. LeBron is just totally a different situation altogether because no one can really truly define LeBron by using other people's example. He's not Jordan. He's not Magic. None of that stuff. And the incredible thing to me about LeBron in so many ways, even though his background is what it is, his mother deserves more credit than they'll ever give him credit for. That's why they always attacked her person when he was on the come up. But he has this centered space where he will not allow anyone to define him, ever. And it's not interested in how you define him. He has this inner thing where he plays the game of basketball unique to himself than any other player. That's where the comparisons drop. And he has found a way to utilize brilliance in the form of basketball and keep steady to his IQ without submitting to anyone else's opinion of what he should be doing.
Yeah,
all those categories put him in a totally undefinable place.
I can tell you, when it came to Moses Malone, Mo had over 500. And gentlemen, good evening. Appreciate that I'm taking part in the discussion. But Moses Malone, about 30 miles from where I live in Richmond, Virginia, he had played right up the road. Yes, sir. But he played on the campus of Virginia State, you know, with the guys playing street ball. But the sad thing about it, you had recruiters coming up to his mom's house with stakes, you know, trying to imply that they were so poor that they would just want this piece of steak. And also Lefty Gazelle camped out in front of his damn house where he just wore Moses down. And it's a picture where Moses, because Lefty had this New Yorker. Everybody saw this blue New Yorker coming down the road. They said, that's Lefty Gazelle again. And Lefty was doing some cookie shit, you know.
Right.
But the sad thing about it was that when Lefty came in there, Lefty put so much pressure on the poor kid and that he decided to go to Maryland, but they had him digging a ditch. And that day after he digged the ditch, he went inside with the ABA. He said, fuck this. I'm not going to be digging no ditch and no photo ops and doing this hard labor. That ain't going to happen.
No shit.
So that was the main thing why he jumped ship and let Giselle start screaming, hollering. He did what? It was like, my prize mule is gone. I can't believe he's gone. He's gone. Because let Giselle wanted to make Maryland the UCLA of the East Coast. Well, we saw how that happened. Quality players, but he was a hell of a recruiter, but won't shit as a head coach, in my opinion.
Lefty, I mean, he had the right name. You know, everything went left, you know, with that cat.
That's
right?
An understatement.
You know what I mean? Yeah, exactly. Everything went
that's
left.
That's an understatement.
That yeah, you know, he was, you know, Lynn Bias situation. He was the head coach with the Lynn Bias situation when that took place, too. And he got Cam behind that, I believe, as well. There's always you know, Shady Grady with, you know,
Trissel. That's
Trissel.
The summer story that came out. It was a lot more, but that's the summer story
it
that
is.
Came out.
Yeah, there's more. You know, he did the same thing when Albert King was coming up out of Brooklyn, right? Albert King was the number one prep when Lefty got him, right? SI did a whole story on Albert King. The only thing about, and Albert, you know, he ended up having, you know, a little problem too with the, you know, with the chalk, I'll call it that. Yet Albert never improved, right? The same player he was in the NBA was practically the same game he had when he was just tearing shit up in Brooklyn on the playground with Fly Williams and his brother and all these brothers out there just putting in work. You know, Albert just that kind of guy. So he was that top recruit too, akin to Moses when he came out. I knew a cat from Jersey that went to Virginia State. Is that in Petersburg, by the way? Virginia State University.
Yeah, it's Virginia.
Where's it located?
The city?
Ettrick.
Virginia. Yeah. They call it Ettrick,
okay.
But it's still
yeah,
near
because when Moses was in high school, he used to go up there and play on the campus, correct?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, because this is where he met him at. So when Moses was with Billy, you know, he got, you know, caught with tickets, and at the time, you know, T-Mac, Mike, is that hotel right across the street from the Garden, correct? The big hotel across the street from Madison Square Garden on 7th Ave, correct? Okay, no one's there. All right. So there is one. And so when the NBA teams came to town, that's where they stayed at that time. And, you know, having talked to Moses, you know, and seeing where he was, because he was at the height of power when he's with the 76ers, right? I mean, he did really well at Houston, but he was really going well as well. But these guys play on your lack of, you know, other things to try to get you tied
That's
up
right.
with the money, you know? And then Moses got broken off a little bit side bread. He'd have been ineligible for Maryland anyway.
Well, remember when he won the title with Philly, he was only 24, 25 years old. So the blueprint he could have made by being in school was wiped out, except for those
Correct.
Who knew specifically about him. And that was the whole point. All those who knew, they were like, I'm in, or they wanted nothing to do with it. Moses didn't get his proper due, although he helped get Doc Irving his ring. He hasn't been respected. Actually, that whole team hasn't been respected. My man, Andrew Toney, the original Boston Strangler, should have his number retired too. But the whole point is These guys came in, paper, so to speak, and all they did was do work and win. And they should have gotten better taken care of.
What they have, like five Hall of Famers? Cheeks, Doc, Moses, Bobby Jones. I'm missing somebody.
And Sullivan. Yeah.
Those are four Hall of Famers on that squad. Cunningham was the coach.
And
five.
The
coach.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Tony's not in the Hall, I believe. Is he? I don't think he's in the Hall. But at one point,
no,
they had like six.
They should have
right,
retired as members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were. Is Collins in? I don't think Collins is in.
Is Doug Collins?
Collins Hall of Fame. Yeah, Doug Collins.
Collins.
Yeah, he's not in the pro basketball. Yeah, he's not in the Hall of Fame. College probably.
He's not
but
Hall of Fame.
At one time, Philly had like five or six. Is McGinnis in? I believe McGinnis is in, right?
Yes, they have
McGinnis.
We got Patrick Fronhouse. Collins was embarrassed by the fact that the Sixers had Raymond Lewis, I believe, number 18
yes,
in the first
Raymond
round.
Lewis, yep.
And Lewis got embarrassed the shit out of Collins. I was doing research
that low life
for a project called The Best We Never Saw. And the word
low
that come
life
out, yeah, the word that come out, Lewis embarrassed Collins. The story
really
was
that low life gene shoe.
He dropped 50 on it. He dropped 50 on it and demanded that he get the same amount of money that Collins got. And the Sixers
right.
quiet him
right.
and said it was a discipline issue. But the bottom line was he outplayed the boy, and he proved it.
Yes,
he
did.
A live audition, and, you know, Philly was thought dumbfounded. Instead of saying
Pat Williams
yep,
and Gene Shue literally undermined Raymond Lewis because they couldn't figure out how a guy could take this time off and just be so naturally gifted in basketball that did not go through the BS system.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's strange, right? You think coaches would like to play the best players, and if you're the best player, no matter where you came up, they're going to play you. That is such crappiest man, especially. All you have to do is look at that. The best 30 for 30. The 30 for 30, that's a pretty good job. The best 30
it's
for 30,
very
I call, is Marcus Dupree.
Yeah.
The best
yeah.
that ever was, right? The Marcus Dupree story.
Yeah.
And the running back coach is literally saying that, and Barry Switzer was like, he was so talented, we didn't know how to coach him. And that is
that's,
the greatest level of idiocy you can ever hear in a coach. You know, you don't hear that from, you know, these brothers that coach these HBCU legends. They make iron out of iron, right? You have a coach.
You know,
you got the best you know, back in the nation, and they're saying, I'm a ball coach. He was so talented, we were scared. We didn't know how to coach him. What?
I'm gonna give it. First of all, good evening, gentlemen. How y'all doing? First of all, you know your point is well taken. I'm gonna give it a perfect scenario, for one of them. When I was back in Ohio at Ohio State, we had a guy named Herb Williams. We had a guy named Hal Smith. We had the twin brothers and a guy named Clark Kellogg.
Yeah, I remember Clark.
Yeah, Herb.
New York Knicks and the Prince of Herb.
Yep, and your boy and your boy Tony C.
Top Cat.
Tony C. And we had a coach named Eldon Miller. He came from Western Michigan. He came in to replace Greg Taylor. And he was able to recruit that much. And never reached the potential because, you said it correctly, they didn't know how to coach him.
Right.
They would fit him into a system and ruin their career. And to the degree where...
Literally.
Clark Kellogg's knees when he got into the... Because Clark was a monster in college.
He was. He was a major All-American, like a top three recruit. He could have went pro out of high school back then.
He surely could have. But his knees are
and probably should have.
Yeah, that's all my errors. Yeah, I know all these stats. Yeah.
But Fred, that's not his makeup. That was not his makeup. He wanted to go four-year school, and it turned out to be he's doing so well in insurance. He started selling insurance in college. Actually, started selling insurance in high school. He majored in insurance.
Yeah, it's an intellectual brother that doesn't want to be the piece of meat athlete like a Kareem cat. They want to pursue, you know, intellectual pursuits, and ball
that's
is
right.
just something that they love doing and can do well.
And the trick was, Ellen Miller said they couldn't coach. And how he got embarrassed? Because Ohio State played Virginia when they had Ralph Sampson. And they put it on Channel 4 with the late, my man, Al
McGuire and company.
And
Packer.
Al McGuire, that's right.
Yeah.
And Al McGuire said this, I'll never get it as soon as I'm sitting there. If I had this Ohio State team, we'd be undefeated. Oh, man, that was through the whole, on national TV, there's no way that they should be. Even with Ralph Sampson. And because
Al kept it 100.
He kept winning, because like you said, they didn't know how to coach that kind of talent.
Yeah, I mean, a case in point real quick, and to get back to speaking to that time zone and cast, you know, that you balled against the new person. Remember Dale Ellis out of Tennessee?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Remember Dale? Yeah. So Dale, I believe he started with Dallas, and Dick Motta was the coach.
Yes.
Now, if you want to set basketball back 4 million in 12 years, have Dick Motta on the sideline. Okay. Right. I mean, you know, into the fat lady sings bullshit. He's lucky he had Casey Jones on the bench trying to keep him going. But Dick Motta would set NBA basketball up. Matter of fact, when he was coaching the Kings and Harold, remember Harold, Villanova Harold?
Yes.
Freshly, Harold's out here still. So, Harold's, Harold, he's cool. And so Harold, the way he was talking about, he said Dick Motta, when he was coaching us, he had us hating everybody, and it all started with him. You know what I mean? And so Motta was Dale Ellis's coach. Dale looked like he couldn't bust a grape because with Dick Motta in Dallas. Then he went to Seattle, all-star.
And turned out.
All-star. And you see that a lot. If you get the right connect, there are system players. And then there's players who can play universally. Like Steve Kerr, he lasted a long time career. He was a system player. And he was the guy that could knock the three off with the Duncans, the Jordans, this, that, and the other. But if you had to build your team one to one a standalone, like on a team that's practically, just starting out, he's not going to be that kind of player. He lasts in the league for 2 years. But he ends up getting a double-digit career because he always is in the right spot.
And there's something. I'm gonna give a classic case where wrong place, wrong time, and the wrong situation. I would have loved to see, and probably Mike and you guys can chime in on this. I would have loved to see Sonny Hill as a coach rather than a commentator. They weren't gonna let it happen, but I'd love to see him as a coach.
Oh, I mean, speaking directly, Sonny would have put something together because Sonny was always a loquacious stand-up person. You know, a real quick story to Sonny. So when my father came up and was playing in the Eastern League, right, Sonny brought him up, right, from Tennessee State Day. He came up with a family in Jersey, but long story short, he's playing with Sonny on the same team, right? So they're going to one of these Eastern League games, and, everything's drive-through, played in. Elementary school. These brothers just love to hoop. And he said they get pulled over by the cops because they're running late for the game, right? And, so 5-0 rolls up on Sonny, and then my father's like, he said, listen, I'm from the South. I never seen anyone dressed down and talk this kind of back to a white cop. Like, Sonny Hill was laying on him, when he came in. So it's that kind of bravado And that kind of persona that we talked about Jim Brown earlier, no compromise. We're going to do it eloquently, no kiss ass, no backpedal. You're going to stand in your own Jones as a black man and know how to do it where it stuns a person, where you're going to do it in the correct way and you're going to prosper. Sonny performed his own path. He is the originator of the Summer League. Sunny Hill Summer League in Philly is the jump off of any professional Summer League anywhere. He was the model for that. Because he had professional players playing it. Bill Bradley, those guys in his peak when they were playing with the Knicks, they all rolled down there. I mean, I played the Sunny Hill Summer League. There was two of them, right? Like, there was the Sunny Hill and it was the Baker. And those were hot days in Philly. And Sunny was like the spearhead. And you're right. I mean, John Chaney, right? You know, he's another guy, too, that should have been in the NBA. But he had no back down, kiss ass, shuffling, moonwalk attitude.
He just tore shit up in the
Eastern League because they didn't want to deal with his persona in the NBA.
Let me ask you a question. Let's be real now. Now, you know John Chaney. John Chaney would be fighting the players.
No one would have ever had your back more than John Chaney, though.
That's true, too.
Right? To be, you know, no one would ever have your back more. And he's not going to be one of these old school oppressive type, you know, Adolf Rupp, you know, type suppressive shit. But he's going to challenge your manhood.
That's true.
But
that's
he's
true.
Only trying to bring out the best in you from what's inside of you. Aaron McKee, Mark Macon and them dudes, Tim Perry, a lot of them brothers, you know, play with him. I mean, they kill for Coach, you know what I mean? And they didn't have to because he raised him the right way. He'd fight for him. He could read Tyler Powery's bullshit. He's seen enough of that crap in his whole life.
Yeah, I was around when it happened.
Yeah.
I was in the league.
You know, but those kind of brothers like that, they're going to get you to the next level.
Yeah.
That's why those brothers, you know, these Robinsons and these brothers that got those captains in the NFL, they know what to do. And some schools produce way more professionals than others across the board because they didn't see it as a separatist state like my school, your school. They just seen it where we can all pitch in and help them. You put together where you have a merit and all these people together. It was no division. It wasn't the biggest message to us, like an HBCU division shit. That must be some new stuff. You know, but back then, you know, it was all one particular melting pot of the same generation that is producing for the same thing. We'll compete like hell against each other, but we're all family from the same system.
Yeah, and you know something? You were right about the reason I was laughing because, you know, in the 10 years I was running the league, man, Gene Shu and Mata, can somebody else get another job? Come on. Give me a break. Oh, God.
He was all part of that old network where they kind of control careers and networked against players and stacked the deck against certain people from being successful. You know, it's like when in the modern day world, if you look at it, was like, you know, T.O. and then Allen Iverson, you better hope they never get hurt because they're never going to get a chance once they get hurt.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Once you get hurt, they like, I ain't going to fight. T.O.'s like, shit, I can still ball.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. The physical came back.
But you see how the poison tongue is thrown on these people? I mean, how they immediately mark them with the negative shit because they can't handle, they can't control. Or they want no part of somebody who's going to speak their truth. Unfortunately, some were a little too quick of a bit, like T.O. was. He just told the truth, and he didn't want to hear bullshit, and he didn't want to listen to bullshit either. And nowadays, you don't have to have players put up the little shit they had to put up with back in the day.
I got you on that, Mike. Where we put John Moran in? I mean, I know him. I've been beating up on the man to death, but when the daddy likes hanging out as being the sidekick,
Lord have mercy.
And
then
you
Lord
got people who are gangsters.
Well,
Patrick, you know yourself. There's gangsters out there. No, but let me just say this. I had a good friend of mine, Gary Flowers, who worked with Jesse Jackson. They got people who know straight-up gangsters as well as Jim Brown. When we had Jim Brown on our show, two things
right.
he said back in the day. He said, number one, if a person wants to be a so-called activist, just see what the person does when their money get cut. That's number one.
Yeah,
number
that's
two,
true.
He said the reason when I ran and got up so slow because I was conserving energy because I was going to wear their ass out when I came back again.
That's exactly what it was.
And third thing he said about Paul Horner.
Right.
Yeah, but third thing he said was, I said, Mr. Brown, I said, when Paul Horner made a racial slur, what was his problem? He said, well, he probably had too much to drink. So those are the conversations we had straight up with Mr. Brown.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you're right. It was a conservation of energy, not some slow psych you out bullshit. Tim Brown had never had to psych out anybody, right? He just shows up on presence and performs. He was correct. You get up slow, you get your body machinations to all get reconnected because you just got kabanged, right? And at the time when he played, he's getting eye gouged. Poked in his neck when he's in those
man,
piles.
Please.
All kinds
please.
Of shit was going on under those piles,
please.
Right? So by the time he got up, he was still, right, at the time he got up, man, he was still trying to find out where his jockstrap were the way these motherfuckers were doing shit back then. You know what I mean? So you had to connect yourself.
They spent half of the show, The Violent World of Sam Huff, talking about their obsession, not confrontation, but obsession with
good
Jim
word.
Brown.
Good word.
They couldn't
good handle. Word. Good word. And you're, yeah, it was Sam. Yeah, Sam Bluff. That was some New York Giant, New York media hype it up thing because, you know, Brown was that cat. They needed to create some kind of contrast, you know, battle, this, that, and the other. But to your point, right, about Moran. So that is the easiest pick on subject matter known to man. And watch all these media dum-dums and talking heads just pile on over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a picture of Chris Kamen in 2016. Remember Chris Kamen, the interesting looking, you know, 7-foot center, you know, unrenowned that played with the Clippers, right? Played for a number of years, had, you know, a real interesting balding look. You remember Kamen? Kamen is a gun fanatic, right, where he's looking like RoboCop. They got pictures of Kamen packing heat, guns, rifles, automatic pistols online back in that era. No word on Chris Kamen, no suspension. Morant is doing this monocle thing. He's riding in the vehicle. He's being silly. Obviously, he may be on some other stuff as well. And he has this, you know, pistol and star. He's not pointing. He's not doing things to the other. So the NBA said, oh, my God, we can't do this. He's holding a pistol and he's holding a gun. This is just such crockett manifestus BS. Now, no one applauds Morant. It's easy to pick because whoever's filmed that video is not your friend. He's got to go through his
that's part of the problem.
His jurisprudence is right. But, you know, when you know what puzzles me is when the thing you continually hear as the travesty of what he's doing is how much money he's going to lose. What the fuck?
Lost.
Always the money thing, right? In other words, how about the fact you just need to get your carrot together? And if you take the loss physically with cash, you're going to do that anyway. But to make that as the only criteria for what you're doing is not to call for help, right? Because if all of us are coaching a young man and you're a coach and you're raising people up that are eventually going to go professional, right? You're not concerned. Yeah. You're not looking for your cut. But what's my percentage after you go pro? Like Rick Pitino and Jamal Mashburn. Another story for another day. They're still married. How many more car dealerships are you going to finance for the Pitino family, Jamal? That's another story for another day.
Yeah.
So when Jamal got broken off, Pitino latched to him when he seen that contract, and now they're business partners. No, Jamal's making money. Pitino can't think. So Jamal becomes the fighter.
Jamal making money after the zoo.
That's my point. Right? But he's linked with a former player. Imagine, that's the dirt of Pitino. I think that's, imagine you coach a kid or coach a player, and they go professional. That's all part of it. Their talents and skills help them get there. But I'm going to latch on. Hey, don't forget about coach. Let's get a business deal together. that's what happens. That's not in the spirit of how the game goes.
Yeah.
But that's the way they play it. So a guy like Morant, you know, with his situation and the fact that he's not making the best decisions, but they knew that about him long before, and they got another video for him to go viral, and he's dealing with these situations, this, that, and the other. I see no reason to pile on at all, because that's something he's got to work on in his own. But it's all of us, though, young people who've been packed.
You know, I'll tell you this. At this point, with what's happened to him, and I read an article today about him, and I think there's some substance to it. You know, he took himself off Twitter or social media today.
Right.
And I think he needs to have a mental break. Someone needs to have some long talk with him, a middle break from, because I think there's a more pressure on him than what we think to not only to play, but to sustain other people who's under him and with him, family, which I think is affecting him. I think that's really part of the problem. I'm not
you're correct. Not everyone's built. Look at Tyson, right? He lost 300 million, right? Mike was doing any and everything. He said, listen, 5 years ago, I was in QB Hall. He's like, I was in QB Hall 5 years ago before I came heavyweight champ. How do I handle that shit?
Yeah.
Right?
That's tough. You know, and being around pro athletes, I've been around football and basketball. You know, what people don't understand, being a professional athlete ain't what a lot of people think it is. They get locked into the access and finances. But what guys got to go through, and really, some guys ain't really so for it. Some guys are not.
Pearl Washington, right? Pearl Washington, seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
Pearl.
That's a
right, Pearl. You know, I mean, you know, so Pearl again, yeah, you know. Now, Mark Jackson on the chat, I mean, there's some familiarity with, because that's like my timeline with dealing with some right.
Pearl,
and he was with the Nets, right? When you were there. You were there back.
That's right before I got there. And believe
right before
me,
you got there.
Oh,
yeah, and so people are like, well, what happened to Pearl and the Pros? Pearl will say, listen, man, I hated the NBA because it was business every day. And it's an old saying in the end, back to your professional athlete statement, and this is from the journeyman. See, the majority of the NBA is journeyman. It's not the superstar. They're like 10% of the league. Right?
And that's
it's
a skill. That's a skill.
Right, exactly. Matt Barnes, he's catching. I know Matt's at high school. I mean, I would ask Matt in the summer, you know, hey, so what's happening next year? Like, he took his contract right now with Phoenix. Right? He said, hey, whomever. I mean, he's like, he already knew. Like, listen, I'm a role player in the league. Whoever's breaking me off the most, that's where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
Literally.
Mm-hmm.
The mindset. And he ended up, 15 years of career, kind of set with the Warriors for the championship. And he felt like he didn't even deserve a ring. Touch it, but he legitimately felt like, because he literally every summer work out, coach him up or whatever, and he's like, listen, I mean, so what's happening next year? Oh, I'm going to, you know, hey, man, whoever's breaking me off, that's where I'm going. So it didn't matter. And those are the majority of the NBA. Like Jeff Green, right?
True.
We see him with Denver, you know, putting in work. Jeff's been, what, 10 teams?
And guess who else? Kwame Brown. That's what he did.
Yeah. That's right. And these cats, Top Cat, the majority of the NBA are role players. Billy Thompson, you know Bill, right, Louisville.
Yes,
he's down in Florida. I'm getting this preacher thing on. Billy played for it. He started with the Lakers. The Lakers got too many funny stories on Billy in some situation. I'm not going to talk about them because they're beyond hilarious. But Kareem always got some funny stories about Billy, you know, showing up to practice or game with two left shoes. Billy, woohoo, we need the right shoe, right? And this is that, Billy's a great brother. But, hey, listen, talk to these dudes. Whoever was breaking them off, and they have a long career. So the majority of these players who bounce around team to team, look at Miami, right? They've got seven undrafted players.
Seven unsigned players.
Right. That's what I'm saying. They get good, they're going to leave. Al, you know, you look at Horford of the Celtics, he's bounced around. Right, Brogdon's been with a few teams himself. He was the man of the year.
Right. Money too.
Exactly. These cats bounced around the Knicks, got a bunch of bounce around dudes on their squad. Derrick Rose and Fournier, they couldn't get them off the bench. I don't know why Steven will never play them, but it looks like they could have helped some of them when they get to Miami. But that bounce around, they'll build another team next year. They'll implode it. Now the Lakers are going to get blown up again. You know, they're going to move pieces around. So these players who know that, their thought process is they go, I never disliked basketball until I started getting paid to play basketball. That's the monster.
And here's something also people don't understand. And I had to learn it once I got in the league. And it will blow your mind. There are guys who are in the league who don't like basketball.
Yeah.
They're just like what basketball brings. I'm saying to myself, how can you be
that good
a athlete? It becomes the job. The love was lost the moment they got hurt and they found out, you know, who they were and these contracts and those labor negotiations and all those things like that. And then they're in four cities in three nights and they don't even know where they are. Literally.
I said, matter of fact, a conversation that I had with one, God bless his soul, Woods one time. And Woods didn't give out names. He said, Patrick, at the time, what do you say? There's about four or five guys in the team that don't like basketball. I said, what do you mean? He said, take my word for it. But as I got in the league, I was in it for 10 years and going, you know something? That guy, he don't really like playing. You can see it, you know?
Nowadays it's evident, right, because they just take breaks. Like last year's Lakers, I mean, Westbrook, yeah. LeBron, and Davis, they'd be at the end of the benches counting their money, laughing their ass off when the Lakers are losing by 30.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and that Iron Man Wilt, you know, stuff, I mean, that stuff doesn't exist anymore because the money. Plus, the thing is, it's super difficult with the memes, the social media, and all these other, in the coverage is insane. They got all these analytics that show the best player groups, the statistics you can't hide from nothing, and it's hyper-pressurized. But the number one thing that is a major trouble of the NBA that hardly talked about, but a person can research it and find out about it pretty quickly. The number one impact on how that schedule works and how they run their system, and it impacts the coaches, the players, and the referees, is sleep deprivation.
Yep.
It's a nighttime league. Across the country, and they suffer strongly from sleep deprivation. I mean, cats will come into town, players I would know, and they are sleeping literally up until game time.
I can believe that.
They get in that bad weather conditions. The flight gets in at 3 a.m. You play at 8 on the second night of a back-to-back.
That's one of the reasons why Phil Jackson gets the research to cut back on shoot-arounds through the day.
Well, he tried to cut a deal where he only wanted to make like 60% of the travel because it was killing him. You know, because the travel's rough. Baseball is 162 games, very few days off. And then when they go to places like Texas, and they may have more dome stadiums now, but that old Ranger Stadium was a deficit.
Yes.
And then the Chicago Cubs had those day games, and they couldn't really adjust the night game. So all that glory, ya-ya, Ross, Tiscumba shit about professional sports and not money. I mean, NBA players and the sleep deprivation, it is huge.
Yeah.
Taps here, it's all life.
Very true.
All for the sake of who? People don't like that all of a sudden. I remember Eric Gordon talked about it like, shit. I mean, we had three games in Fortnite. I didn't know what city I was in or what airplane I was in. And then you show up to the arena, and you got every night 18, 19,000 strangers staring at your ass.
and critiquing your game.
Yeah, critiquing your team. texting us, we speak, social media, seeing who you're dating. On the media, they got groupie sites and shit where they're rating the players and their chicks and shit and who they got. The groupies got better statistics on their private websites than the analytics people.
Yeah.
Speak off.
Yep.
Cats are getting all kinds of trouble, man. And you see it all the time. How are you psychologically built for this?
When all this is thrown
at you and you really don't have the maturity to kind of handle it, money just exemplifies who you are. So if you're an undisciplined person, right, still trying to find who you are, if you ever even find who you are, you know, it just magnifies your emptiness. So guess what you got all this money, you're off to the strip club, and you can't come down after the game, right? You know that. You play a full game of sports. How long did any of us take us to come down after a full activity? Hours.
Which leads to another reason why they push and they got it. They're trying to hold back and criminalize guys getting marijuana to calm yourself down. That's behind a lot of it. I was told.
Robert Parrish? There was an NBA player in a hotel room that left so many, so many splits behind. You thought they were trying to build a forest fire.
Hell yeah.
A lot of people was doing that per se, in terms of these activities. Now it's CBD oil, right? Right, the CBD. But then again, you can only have a certain level of THC, right? Because there's a legality there. But the big players are not rotating certain things to offset the physiology, and the chemistry would be utter idiocy. And it would be mind-blowing if some of your favorite legends, some of your favorite people, make A-Rod look like, a person who's a good dude. It makes A-Rod look like a person who only got good drinking Yoo-Hoos and chocolate cakes or some shit. We all know the difference to that.
And see, here's my problem, with it, is the fact, forget the players. These owners get more nice. Please, talking about cocaine with owners, give me a freaking break. I know.
Well, somewhere Jim Irsay is saying, give me another hit of that.
Please. Him and somebody else, one of his boys. I ain't going to steal one. I don't believe me. Please. They've snorted up Peru.
Professional sports, entertainment, professional sports, any business where there's a lot of resources and income and money being moved has every level of debauchery known to man within its midst. It's just basic. It attracts it.
It's true.
It naturally attracts it.
Say, Mike.
Yeah.
Mike, you there?
Come here.
Mike, you there, Mike?
Yep.
I stepped up. Yeah. I got to hit you with something. One of the topics that we talked about on the gambling end, I got some information today in regards to gambling. A demographic of people who are grossly involved in gambling to a degree where some stuff might be happening soon is guess who? College students are gambling out the freaking gazoo. With all kinds of points. A guy sent me some information today. It's mind-blowing. I kind of thought about it, but not to this extent. It's something that has to be watched.
But you know what? We've talked about that with the student thing, right, in the past. But true, when you get the numbers, it's out of control. But remember, when you ever in the crowd scan college game, right, and you just see these faces of these students totally broken down and depressed, it's not because their school is losing. They lost money.
That's right.
Straight up. You know, I mean, you see them holding their hands together like they're praying, and oh my God, how am I going to cover the damn mortgage?
Right.
Them mofos that be in the stands looking like they're getting ready to perform the Japanese honorarium of suicide harikari. They lost money.
And I saw
those crowd scans are lovely because we're looking at all the people who got ganked by Vegas or DraftKings or whatever else they're playing.
Let me tell you, you're right. Because when I was in Ohio last week, they got two spots for FanDuel and what's the other one I forgot. I'm going, it's right across to the damn campus. I'm going, well, dang, just like that. And then when the guy sent me his article, I'm going, you know something? That's right. You know, it's wild.
You know what? You know how screwed up it is, man. Because I can only, you can see the game. I mean, you know how screwed up it is when we watch, say, the NBA playoffs. And they got one of these betting tools. Okay, your chance. Will Bam Adebayo grab 12 rebounds? Yes or no? That's the line for this.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Tatum is this many 3-point shots. That's the line for this. And these fofos are sitting there grinning and shucking and jiving and sending people's pockets to the graveyard. Right there.
They don't hold back.
Now, what is wholesome about that?
They don't keep quiet about it anymore. It's too much money for them to keep quiet about. Everybody understands. Everybody's letting it go. And somebody would have to be really stupid.
I got a question, Patrick. It's about money.
Mm-hmm.
With Amazon or is it whichever one is going to be doing live streaming NFL games, what's with this flex schedule on Thursday?
Prime TV.
Yeah, Prime, yeah.
Yeah, flex schedule on Thursday. Well, you should have heard the speech that Goodell gave today on why they're doing it. I'm going, Russ, stop. Just stop. I mean, don't be trying to blow smoke.
I tell you what, Bezos, though, the way they broadcast those games and break them down, he can put a whole new flair on the broadcast version. It's better than any visual of the major network. And they started to mimic him, but they were a little late. But the money's got invested with the different cameras. The broadcast crew sucks and all that, and the pregame, whatever. But the visuals, they have one channel where they, it's like two you can watch, right? And there's one where they'll break it down actually like a video game, right? All the players and their alignment, they'll highlight them, they'll show their pass routes or the routes they take via the technology on the ground. So if they're breaking deep, you're going to follow it. Someone's coming over out the flat, you're going to see it. You're going to watch the lineman line up and it itemizes that stuff. It's a different visual experience completely for football, which, again, reinvigorates what the NFL does best. Have people loving that football.
Yes, they do. They know
they have them loving that football. And Bezos, the runner of Amazon, the implementation, because he's got the crazy loot. I mean, the best technologists, Amazon's technology is insane, right? For them to do the production, so they hire the best engineers.
Yeah.
So they brought that flavor into the football coverage. They need better announcers and broadcasters per se, because what the college do from ESPN and Al's kind of old and shit. They need to bump that shit up because the visuals, the crowd coverage, the way they swing the angles, the visual, the optics of the game. If you've been watching football for a long time, total different level for their first year really covering. So no telling what they're going to break out next year because they kind of toy with it. But then over the course of time, you start seeing some of the other productions try to mimic the visuals. It's really bringing you into the stadium with a different twist, and they give you two options of how you want to view it, which totally gets a new recreation. Again, it can be a 10-7 game, but on the visuals of how they can break down some of it, it has a different effect when watching in a different
yes.
district.
And know what it does too? It enhances
yes.
your betting. It enhances your betting.
Yeah, I missed that
That's
part.
What it does.
I'm talking about this purist shit. Yeah.
Before we
You're
get
right.
the final
it,
thoughts,
place
thoughts,
your bet.
We need to point out two things that you and Patrick were talking about, Eric.
Yes,
they
sir.
Will tell you now when a broadcast is available how you're making your money and how you're losing your money. That's what
yes,
they'll
sir.
Say. They won't
yep.
say it in terms of dollars and cents. They'll say it within the Florida game. But that's what your new analysis
you
will do for
spot
you.
On. Spot mm-hmm. on. And that's how you can say, well, I mean, in Vegas, if you're sitting there, you know, having your 12th Long Island iced tea, sorry, Reggie, you know, slow down, bro, slow down. I'm messing with you, Reg. You know, watching all the TV screens of the game, right? You can say, well, okay, Lamar Jackson. Well, Lamar Jackson, so the third quarter ends, fourth quarter starts. They'll send a line out, you know, fingertip level, do the tech, warp speed, where you got your account lined up, or you can go to the window, because Vegas will still let you walk up to the window, and you can say, hey, I want to take $100 on that 7-1 odds that Lamar's going to run for 25 yards in the fourth quarter.
There you go.
So, three quarters, you were just chilling. And now all of a sudden you got Tim. Oh, shit. Okay, what the? Oh, 25 yards, fourth quarter. Oh, man, yeah, he's going to get that one place to bat.
Mm-hmm.
It's itemized like that.
Yep. Yep.
How many free throws will
Drew
from Miami shoot in overtime? They may send a line out on that.
That's going to kill
it. And with the odds on, you can place a bet. I knew Cats
That's
would go to Reno, right, because it's right down the street from that. They'd go to Reno and show me, you know, you talk about the betting grid. They say, well, yeah, I did good. I placed a bet. Say it's a football game, Purdue versus Michigan State. Yeah, I took a bet that Purdue has a really good field goal kicker. They don't really, you know, do well on third down. I took a bet that the field goal kicker would kick two field goals. No, attempts. The heck with making it, but have two field goal attempts in the second quarter. And I won, you know, $500 and put $1 to bet because he had three field goals.
There
you it's go. Itemized like that. That's why it's endless drainage and endless options.
Yeah. Hey, and it's going to get worse when it gets better.
Gentlemen, we've thrown out some great discourse. Ashe to Brother Brown. Ashe to Sister Tina Turner. And there's mm-hmm. lots of stuff out here. As we get to our final thoughts, first of all, Patrick, first and foremost,
I tell you what, you know, the Hall of Fame, I'm scheduled possibly to do the Hall of Fame this year up in Canton. It's going to be Browns against the Jets. And oh, Lord, I pray some of the Jets are going to create them. Aaron Rodgers was captain. Oh, come on. Give me a break. But at the Hall of Fame ceremonies, of course, you guys know they have, you should know, they have a special ceremony and a meeting and a setting only for the Hall of Fame players. Only about two or three reporters who have ever been in there can get in because they want all media cut out. They have mentioned guys who are the greatest ball players in the league and whole nine yards and the whole, you know, who's the greatest. And somebody said because of Jerry Rice's longevity, he's the greatest player of all time. But I do know this, and it's been confirmed on numerous occasions, when all the Hall of Fame players come into that room, ain't but one play they stand up for, and it ain't Jerry Rice. He just passed.
There you go.
Jim Brown.
That's true.
When he walks in the room, they stand up, and everybody sits down.
No shit. Reggie, I'm surprised that Moses Malone didn't go to HBCU.
Did he not care, or did they not care? Set it off.
Why are you there?
He's eating that sandwich.
Yeah, exactly. He's chopping up them green onions for that tuna fish.
J.S. sandwich.
Professor. Same question
and,
to you.
That's some bald eggs with it.
And please, please don't break out the miracle whip.
I was wondering when you were going to be the attorney. I was about to trash all y'all. But, you know.
Remember that whip to sell of blood again. That whip to sell of blood.
We've lost two accidents in the last week. Jim Brown.
Right.
I will always, you know, think about, you know, I was sitting here thinking, I've been out of school 48 years. He retired just as I was beginning to go to college, and we're still talking about him among the greats. And it shows the effect that he had even back then when it was far less TV, most and radio was probably more prominent than television back then. But you know, we still got film of him, and we can see, in spite of how ESPN think nobody played or nobody was any good before they came along and made it. But you know, we lost a universal guy who not only was great in football, but he was also a great actor, in Jim Brown. And with Tina Turner, you know, two of the prettiest legs you've ever seen in your life, bar none.
Yep.
And honor where honor is due, and both of them are due honor. You can reach me at blackhair.com on social Facebook. And as I leave, you know, I'm working on this project that's preserving the history of all Black high school. We have actually begun working on a segment of that to put it on the web, on the World Wide Web, not only at the local level, but nationally and internationally. And I'm taking this class in AI, and it's the darnest thing in the world, but it's going to take a lot of work. But anyway, you know, we want my final honor this week to be to those guys and the ladies who gave it all as we go into Memorial Day, because that'll be coming up next Monday. And on Wednesday, my baby will turn 40 years old. So Rob, big ups.
Amen.
Reggie, come on with it.
Well, you know, what I've seen so far is Bill Russell make his transition to the Rob ancestor, then Jim Brown, Tina Turner. But yet, we still see the foolishness going on in this judicial system where Castillo was gunned down years ago. His only crime was he had a licensed gun. And when the cop was asked, why'd you do it? I don't know. You know, it goes back to a certain basketball player. As many people have said, you ain't no gangster, but we can make you an example if you really want to play this card. It's not getting funny anymore, because I see LeBron James play on a torn ligament in his foot and giving 40 points, but yet everybody else is walking around trashing the young man. And I'm saying, hell, some of y'all just get a damn hang now. You ready to cry and get the fetal system. But he played with a torn tendon in his foot. And Negroes are running around talking about, what's the excuse now? I have come to the conclusion that the hell with Black folks, that mean you no good, because they want something to bitch about to serve their masters very well. Just my opinion.
That's nicely put. Yep.
Is there?
Oh, where's Eric? I'm waiting on you. Not ask you first.
Yeah, I mean, always good to build with the brothers. You know, I mean, a lot of astute, you know, viewpoints, fresh. You know, I mean, fresh takes never stale because there's a lot of direct experience. You know, here, you know, James Brown, Jim Brown. You know, these guys are out at the same time. You know, and just, you know, stay it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. You know, a brother named Brown, representing the Brown man, the melanated man, playing for the Browns team, wearing that deep sepia brown jersey. These things are not coincidences when you have these brothers in place. These similarities, this symmetry in context and name. You know, there was a time where there was, and it still is a time for those who can tap within deep themselves, they're able to do it. You know, the original AI still exists. It's called hieroglyphics. You know what I'm saying? There's more data built in those hieroglyphics than anything AI can compromise, right? Which means that I'm saying is to say that we're the architects of many things. And it's when we bring in factors of individuals who represented and set themselves up to be strong, identifying role models of people as they come through the cycle. And so Jim Brown, you know, was beyond, you know, people quoting his football statistics and all these other things like that. And I come to mind, and we'll leave it that, with the movie that was once done that really kind of identified a lot of different concepts. Three the Hard Way, Brown, Kelly, Williamson. You know, Brown, Kelly, Williamson. So you had set it up. You got Brown, Jim Brown, you know, running around in platform shoes and, you know, a tight jumpsuit, chasing crackers with a, you know, oversized gun. That was part of the scene. And Jim did not use stunt doubles, right? And you've got the Hammer, former Kansas City Chief, you know, out there, you know, part of the Lloyd Brigade of the brothers that went to Kansas City and the stables, where he was able to be loquacious and then was able to develop two his own directorial skills, right? Williamson and Brown did the same thing. And then Jim Kelly, you know, he was the person that when Muhammad Ali was rising, they came up, you know, Bruce Lee made his rise, and then they tried to shift the energy of the warrior image to the celluloid Bruce Lee, and then into Jim Kelly, right, who creates this role model, brother with a fro, you know, walking tall, standing up, nice with the martial arts that were developed by brothers in Africa, brothers in East Africa, where martial arts originates, right? So they said all this chemistry, all this historical artifactual things where you can do a combination where when you're looking at this, you're really staring into the depths of your ancestry in these images. And these brothers is wise enough, be it instinctive, be it by, you know, inspiration. When they put these things together, they were actually formatting the system of how if you manifest these things and take care of them, you set the right example. Three the Hard Way. Check it out.
All right, all right.
Gary, and I waited all night to say this, but it's been intriguing as all this has manifested how all of them are dying, man. They're all gone. You know, I was sitting here thinking about my girl, and next thing I know, who's left? Sade, Khan?
Yeah.
Less than one hand.
It's been a dry 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have a thing about the Washington Football Club. Washington Football Club might be getting a new name again. Washington Football Club denied the Commanders. The reason why we denied the trademark was because of the Commanders football game between Army and Navy and the commander's team. They had to go back to the drawing board and get the name to wind the fuck up once again. So I embark all you brothers to write to the wife. Don't tell them. Do not go back to the American image. Because it might be a backdoor to get back into it again. With a new owner.
Well, wasn't the commanders what the cavalry was called, right? They had commanders in the cavalry when they were rounding up, allegedly, the so-called Indians.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's their play on words. They always got the trick up the sleeve. Okay, yeah, we'll change their name, but we still are commanding this thing because that's what the cavalry was.
Well, I think that this is a backdoor to get back to the Indian name again.
Right.
And make one more.
Exactly. You know.
They ever called 4 o'clock Saturday, 7 o'clock in the east. Sunday will be Memorial Day classic music at 4 o'clock, 7 in the east, Sunday afternoon. So,
there you go.
Saturday is both days at 4 o'clock. Here we go.
Right. Hey, real quick to that, Mike and G, Mavis Staples is still rolling. She may not be one to linger because she feels like a bud of finger.
But you know, you sit back and you look at the roll call and it's like, damn, who's left? But even more depressing, there used to be an infrastructure. You could turn on the station, and there would be a tribute to so-and-so.
Right.
There was no tribute. I mean, you might have found something here and there on satellite radio, but they didn't really care. And that bugged the fuck out of me because blues is our music. And nobody... As much as they say that seemed like nobody gave a fuck. And unfortunately, that's how they rolled. You know, it's going to take a while. And we know that the stations will play because on top of everything else, she smelled like, you know, they enjoy the fact that she smelled like. They enjoy the fact that Phil Spector created River Deep Mountain High with a string arrangement that was far afield from anything I could come up with, and I grudgingly admitted how great it was, but it wasn't enough. You know, it was one of those deals. There's always the left-handed compliment that smacked them in the face, and that's unfortunately where. But we thank Sister Turner for a gift. I know she thanks Lloyd the Bunker for those legs and the great sound, and thank you, Jim Brown, for never backing down and being who you are. And for you alone for putting this in here. Everybody else, I want you to listen because this is what Gary's been complaining about for the longest time. That happened to all the sports teams in Oakland.
What's better than getting your McDonald's bag? Getting a sweet deal on your bag. Oakland, California. Once one of the most prosperous sports cities in the nation. Being one of the oldest cities in the state to establish a large population, it would be one of the first cities in the West to obtain 4 major pro sports teams. This, however, would not last, as a plethora of events and situations would lead to Oakland's status as a major pro sports city being constantly in jeopardy to this day. This is What Happened to the Sports Teams of Oakland. Oakland's journey into major pro sports would begin in 1960 with the establishment of the Oakland Raiders of the AFL. Strangely enough, the team's main reason for establishment would be at the persistence of then LA Chargers owner Baron Hilton, who was demanding the AFL have more West Coast teams. The Oakland Raiders would begin playing in San Francisco and would quickly be in jeopardy if he moved over a lack of venue in Oakland. However, when it would be agreed upon that what would become the Oakland Coliseum would be built in Oakland, along with the team starting to play at Frank Yuen Field in Oakland temporarily, that finally the Raiders would be secure in Oakland for the immediate future. The Coliseum would be built in tandem with the Coliseum Arena, and both would open in 1966. Building these brand new facilities would carry more than just the reward of keeping the Raiders, as after they moved there in 1966, the NHL's Golden Seals would begin play there in 1967 at the arena. This would be followed by the Kansas City Athletics moving to the Coliseum, becoming the Oakland Athletics. And finally, in 1971, the San Francisco Warriors of the NBA would move to the Coliseum Arena, becoming the Golden State Warriors. This would give Oakland four major pro sports teams. Oakland built it, and they came from zero teams playing in Plymouth to four within just a few years' time. It would be one of the first major cities in the West to become a sports hub of this magnitude, and its new facilities were imperative. The era of major pro sports in Oakland would start off with a bang as well, with the Raiders winning the AFL championship in 1967, the A's winning the World Series 3 years in a row in 72, 73, and 74, the Warriors winning the NBA Finals in 1975, and the Raiders winning the Super Bowl in 1977 and 1981, with the Raiders now being part of the NFL. Almost was going very well in Oakland during this era. Challenge to its status as a sports city would come in 1976 when the Golden Seals would be moved to Cleveland after years of poor attendance. Though not a major blow to Oakland's status as a sports city, it would be somewhat of a precursor to the distant future of sports in Oakland. By 1982, the Coliseum was no longer this shiny new venue that could be used to draw teams. And then Raiders owner Al Davis wanted better. And though the Coliseum was only 16 years old at this point, he decided to move the Raiders to L.A. until 1995, when Oakland would become the better option, in the form of $100 million being spent on what would become known as Mount Davis. This gargantuan structure, added to one side of the Oakland Coliseum, would satisfy Al Davis enough to bring the team back, but would at the same time take away much of the views and aesthetics that the Oakland A's had enjoyed for many years. Heavily funding Mount Davis might have been the single biggest mistake that Oakland made for the future of keeping its sports team, as it would tie up any potential money that could be used for the future stadium for either the Raiders or the A's, while only guaranteeing the Raiders to stay in Oakland for 16 years via the new lease agreement. It didn't vastly improve the rest of the stadium either, rather just replaced one side of it. Any chance at the Coliseum becoming one of those classic ballparks that lasts 100 years was gone once this was built, and by the 2000s decade, the A's would begin to want a new home. The first serious attempt at a new stadium for the Athletics would be in 2006, when the Athletics would propose Cisco Field. This plan would have renderings and a site agreement in Fremont, California, just over 20 miles south of Oakland. Nothing would come of this first plan. However, in 2012, the hopes of Cisco Field being built were revived when a serious attempt would be made to have the A's move to San Jose and have the field built. However, it would be blocked by MLB when the San Francisco Giants objected. From the mid-2000s onward, the status of Oakland as a sports city would be called into question, not just on the basis of its facilities, but also on the basis of fan support. From 2006 to present, the A's have regularly been one of the lowest attended teams in baseball, only achieving more than 2 million fans in a season once since 2006. This would be occurring while across the bay in San Francisco, the Giants would be achieving over 3 million fans a season regularly and enjoying one of the longest sellout streaks in baseball history, with a shiny new ballpark being one of the factors in it. The Raiders as well would begin to struggle at the gate, with some of the lowest attendance in the NFL from the late 2000s into the 2010s, which would result in many tarp seats at the Coliseum and also TV blackouts before the NFL got rid of them. Though there would be several lease extensions in the Raiders' lease and many discussions with the city about a new stadium, along with the team also considering sharing the stadium with the San Francisco 49ers, no serious stadium plan for the Raiders ever really got off the drawing board in Oakland. And Mark Davis, son of Al Davis, would end up moving the team to Las Vegas in 2020 after a previously failed attempt at moving the team to Los Angeles a few years prior. Though the Coliseum was constantly a target of ridicule and questions about the future of it throughout much of the 2000s and 2010s, the Coliseum Arena, at this point known as the Oracle Arena, had not been, as $100 million had been spent to nearly completely gut the arena and renovate it in the 1990s. With the Warriors, it wasn't necessarily that the arena was bad, like that of the Coliseum, but rather ownership wanted a brand new building and out of Oakland. As the Warriors are a shared team between San Francisco and Oakland, and San Francisco has much more wealth, San Francisco would not even have to end up paying for any of the $1 billion plus cost of what would become the Chase Center, which would result in the Warriors ending up vacating Oakland in 2019. And that leads us to the present day. Oakland is now left with just the Athletics, a city that once had four teams, many championships, and much prosperity, has been reduced to clinging on to just one team left, and they may not be there much longer. While there have been many plans and talks about building a new stadium at Oakland Howard Terminal, there has been no concrete official agreement to build a stadium there. And at this point, the Coliseum, with its outdated multi-purpose structure, bad plumbing, aesthetics, and other features, MLB is practically trying to move the team themselves, offering to waive relocation fees if ownership decides to relocate, with the most likely option being Las Vegas at this point. So what is it? What is it that has made Oakland such an unattractive place for sports teams? Well, for one, the city doesn't really have any extra money to spend on its sports teams for facilities. If Oakland is one of the worst large cities in America when it comes to city debt, being over $2 billion in the hole. Also, Oakland hasn't really grown much since the 1960s when the Coliseum complex was built, growing by only about 66,000 people, while nearby San Jose and San Francisco have grown by hundreds of thousands since then. It also simply doesn't have the private wealth like San Francisco does across the bay, which is one of the richest cities in the country when it comes to personal wealth in large cities. San Francisco didn't even have to pay for Oracle Park, the Chase Center, or even Levi's Stadium, as the Chase Center and Oracle Park were 100% privately funded, and Levi's Stadium was 90% privately funded, the remaining 10% not even coming from San Francisco, since the stadium is not located there. Oakland simply did not have the public money to put towards a new NFL stadium for the Raiders, as it went all in on a bad deal to build Mount Davis, and it's looking quite possible that they might not be able to save the A's either, as they are asking for $1 billion from Oakland towards a new stadium, and they and MLB are losing patience. At this point, it truly is up in the air whether Oakland will have any major pro sports teams in its future, but it will be likely decided soon.
Lesson learned. Money talks. And you know what? Runs the marathon. Good night. Everybody, please get safe. Once you get from A to B and back to A, okay.